You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
From Vineyard Theater in New York City, this is Theater Uncorked, where Vineyard artists come together to talk about the process of bringing new works to the stage. I'm your host, Eric Pargotch. For episode 3, we welcome the Vineyard's most produced playwright, Nikki Silver, in conversation with the Vineyard's artistic director, Douglas Abel. The Vineyard's premiere of This Day Forward is Nikki's 9th main stage production at the company, which has also done 3 developmental lab productions of his works. Nikki made his off-Broadway debut here at the Vineyard with his play Pterodactyls, which went on to receive a Drama Desk nomination, an Outer Critics Circle nomination, and won both the Oppenheimer Award and the Kesselring Award. That began his long relationship with the theater and eventually led to his first Broadway production when The Lions transferred from the Vineyard to the Court Theater on Broadway in 2012, starring Linda Lavin in the role of the acid-tongued mother, Rita Lyons. Nikki is joined by Douglas Abel, who has been the Vineyard's artistic director for over 3 decades and has been at the helm of the institution for all of Nikki's productions here. We are thrilled the two could join us during previews of This Day Forward to chat about their history working together. This is Nikki Silver and Douglas Abel in Theater Uncorked at the Vineyard.
Well, this feels a little artificial because Doug and I speak constantly. Even when I'm not working here, we stay in touch. We speak a lot. But we will try to be both edifying and entertaining for the purposes of the Vineyard podcast.
The 2 important E's. Edifying and entertaining.
Yes.
I guess we should start out by trying to remember all these years later when we first met.
It would be 1992, I guess.
I believe so.
I had written a play called Pterodactyls that had many, many readings all over town and got the same feedback from everyone that they liked the play but weren't doing it. And you had someone on the staff here.
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to talk, Doug?
I'll talk.
It's like pulling teeth to get him to chime in. This is what it's like.
My recollection was actually your then agent sent me a gaggle of your plays.
Michael Traum.
Michael Traum.
He's now, I believe, he works
jeweler?
On a dairy farm.
Yeah. Well, he was very nice. Anyway, I give him credit that he was relentless. He called me a lot. It was before the internet. So it was all about calling and sending hard copies of scripts. And I think there were about 3 or 4 of them. And I read Pterodactyls, and I loved it. And I called you, and we met.
Oh.
Correct?
We did meet. I don't remember the phone call. But I remember coming here.
Or your agent arranged
it. First of all, Michael Traum, do you realize, there's a character in a play of mine based on Michael Traum.
Really?
The psychiatrist in Raised in Captivity who goes crazy when her client leaves him was based on his response when I left. Honest to God. Because he went a little nutty. And I don't blame him. I mean, it was a rough, you know, he was a young agent starting out and everybody left him within like a 10-day period. But let's don't dwell on the negative.
But let's talk about that first meeting.
As I recall, I hid a bunch of other scripts in your office.
I just remember at one point we were chatting and you went into a fetal position under the table for an extended period of time. Like, seriously, you did.
Was I upset about something?
No. It was playful. I think we were chatting about not the play, just about life or whatever. And I was asking you probing questions, and I think in your satirical, mock serious way, you feigned being shocked or distressed, and you crawled under the desk and put your hands.
I do remember being probed by you, but I don't recall going under the table. But
emotional probing.
Yeah, huh? That's what we'll tell the lawyers.
And
we were so young.
We were young upstarts in the theater, and we did. I committed at the time to a lab production, which was really quite a production. It really was the production.
Yeah.
Right. In those days, things were a little cheaper to do. And we really, working with David Warren and a really talented cast, we did the production. The concept then, which is a little harder to do now, was that we would fully stage things and not have them reviewed and run them for 3 weeks. And we did it with that cast, and it went beautifully. And I think a year later, we brought it back and polished it up a bit. Yeah. And I also recall, for some reason this is on my mind because of the election challenge we've all had, is I remember it was when Bill Clinton, the lab was when Bill Clinton was first running for president. There was a primary going on. He was running against Jerry Brown, I think, or something.
I don't remember. I worked for that first Bill Clinton election. I was a full-time volunteer registering Democrats. But I was oblivious to any opponents.
Right. It was just, it was very contentious, as I recall, and it just struck me a lot as we were, you know, fast forward to our current venture, and, well, let's just say the day after the election was a tough one.
It was a hard night.
And it was actually lovely, though.
Well, the cast was so happy to be here, to have something to cling to.
Right, and the audience, too. It was a special night, but I thought about the...
I'd be happy if it wasn't so special and the results
exactly.
were different.
Exactly. But I don't know. That was just on my mind because I felt like we started with the Clintons at our most recent show. Well, maybe...
And it was my first profession. I had been doing showcases for a good 7 or 8 years. And I'd had, I believe at that point, only two regional productions, one at the Woolly Mammoth in Washington and one in San Francisco at the Magic Theater of an earlier play called Fat Men in Skirts. But I'd never had a professional production in New York City. And my memory of opening night, in those days it was on a Wednesday, and in those days the Sunday Times was actually published like a silkscreen on Wednesday nights, and Sam Rudy coming around the corner with both the Sunday Review and the Daily Review.
Sam Rudy, our press agent.
Sam Rudy is the press agent. And they were both, what was interesting was they were both very, very positive, but they both had some concerns, but they expressed polar opposite points of view. One liked the play best when it was funny, and one liked the play best when it was serious. But what mattered was the top half of the Arts and Leisure was a picture of Hope Davis and Kelly Bishop and Dennis Cregan from Pterodactyls, and it made us important. Mm-hmm. On a week when people with reputations that already existed opened plays, like Austin Pendleton and Playwrights Horizons, and David Warren said to me, "Do you know what this means?" And I said, "I guess it means they liked it." And he said, "It means you don't have to work at Barney's anymore." I'm waiting. I'll probably have to go back after this play.
Yeah, yeah. So for you, I mean, it was really an extraordinary, working on that show was an extraordinary experience. It just all of, I don't know how to put this, we really didn't know until the first preview. I'm going back to the lab, you know, how it would be responded to.
I knew.
You knew.
I did. I think I did. I don't mean that smugly.
Right.
But I you know, as a young writer in my early, I was 31, 32, workshop and lab and production, I had very, very much convinced myself that if I could get the world to listen to me, they would be very excited. Mm-hmm. And this is a demented way to live, but I do think it's the only attitude that a struggling writer can have, or you won't bother to continue to do it. But other people I knew who wanted to have a life in the theater, that's about their 30s is about when you start going, this isn't working out. I had no money. I'd never earned a cent. So I thought it would be shocking to people at the time. I mean, a play that did address AIDS, that had a lot of jokes, that shifted styles, but I thought people would like it.
I have a distinct memory of Kelly Bishop. I don't know quite the line, but there's a moment in the play when the protagonist reveals that he has AIDS, and the mother's response is, "We'll have a buffet," or like a complete deflection. Correct?
"We'll have a buffet."
Yeah, and I remember I think it was at the first performance, the audience exploded with laughter. And I think for me, that was really it was a profound moment. It was a sort of release and surprise, and oh my God, they get what you're trying to say, and the irony and the shock of it.
And it still gets done constantly. Constantly. I mean, not so much, not major, you know, big institutional theaters. It gets done in colleges. It gets done overseas. I get Pterodactyl's statements, and it's still very widely produced.
I feel like, just to remind people, if they're listening, that when we first did it in 92, we were not out of the woods yet with this disease.
I mean, no!
They were about a year away from, thankfully, some medication being discovered that could at least treat it, but we were not there yet.
Well, I don't think I have my doubts as if the play even works anymore, because in the time when we did it, for a character to say "I have AIDS" was a death sentence. It was a death sentence.
Absolutely.
And now it has a completely different impact. Mm-hmm. So you really have to put it, if you see the play, right, in that kind of historical perspective.
You know, on a personal level, which I didn't say to you, my my very best friend at the time, who was also a theatrical collaborator with me, was struggling with it and passed away around the time of the lab. And I just remember, I don't know, it just every night it was like a source of joy and agony for me to go through it. But it was really meaningful.
You know? I wrote it really in honor of or about my friend Philip Beekman, who had died. But I had a little distance. It had been 5 or 6 years already. And that's the thing. I wasn't sad when I wrote the play. I was angry when mm-hmm. I wrote the play. And that's what we really hadn't had mm-hmm. about the play that addressed AIDS, that had angry humor. We had sad.
Right.
At that point.
It's also interesting.
I sound so self-aggrandizing. Right.
No, I knew what I was doing,
and I'm so clever. And it also
played with stylistically, you know, that kind of Philip Barry world. And it's interesting for me because not that world isn't being revisited in this day forward, but another era is of the 1950s and a kind of style and a kind of a way of conversing and acting and way that people wore clothes in this day forward. And I think that's probably, of all the plays we've done, those two actually, did we ever have another play that we worked on that sort of dealt in a sort of nostalgic or satiric world?
I like style a lot. Mm-hmm. I mean, I like finding the reality in an artificial world mm-hmm. as a playwright quite a bit, and I always think about it all the time. I don't know. I'm trying to think. We've done so many plays together. If I had one that... I generally don't write plays that are set in another mm-hmm. era, so probably not. No. Mm-hmm.
But it's been interesting, too, I think, looking at the last few plays we've worked on together, The Lions and Too Much Sun and Now This Day Forward. I won't say they are thematically related, but they are. And
I got one idea, and I'm draining the swamp.
but there's a real progression in them. It seems to me, I don't mean to overly interpret them, but a kind of gradual acceptance. I don't say forgiveness, but there's.
I
think there's more forgiveness in this play. It takes a while to get there in the play, right? Am I?
No, I think that's true. I you know, last year, the Dramatists Guild Quarterly magazine asked me to write an article about family plays. Now, I have written plays that are not about families. No one cares about them. People don't like them. And I do, when I teach, talk about things like, I think that that plays that last are generally family plays, even if they're disguised as something else. Like Glengarry Glen Ross is a play about brothers with a father. Mm-hmm. It looks like something else. But that is our most basic human relationship is our family, and one that most human beings spend their entire life reacting to, either healing from or trying to reconcile. You know, we do. We spend our whole lives. And I do think if you look at my exploration of the family, I think I have gotten much more forgiving of all of the participants. When I'm young, I know when I started out and I was younger, there was a lot more blame involved. And I don't think there's any blame, actually, mm-hmm. anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm thinking about that. Some of the I'm thinking about which plays we've done of yours that sort of... I didn't feel you as a character or your family history. I guess The Altruist was one of them, uh-huh. maybe.
People didn't like so much in New York. You know, probably my most successful play in certain overseas.
And maybe that's because it's critical or satirical about American values, right?
Maybe.
Yeah.
I liked it too.
My favorite plays that we've done are the ones that have received the least attention, shall we say. So I never really go by that right. kind of stuff. You know, as you know, I adore The Maiden's Prayer. I think that's a really great play.
People don't do that one.
I know, and it's ripe for a revival, I think. I hope it gets done somewhere.
I hope someone revives anything.
Right.
Revive anything.
Right.
This podcast is sponsored by Ramp. Are you the decision maker in your company? Consider this. For the first time in decades, there's a better option for a corporate card and spend management platform. Meet Ramp, the only corporate card and spend management system designed to help you spend less money so you can make more. Most corporate credit cards offer points as incentives, but those points amount to less than their worth in real cash value. Ramp's business cards offer you cash back, real money in your pocket. Plus, you control who spends what with each vendor. And Ramp's software collects and verifies receipts automatically, which means you'll stop wasteful spending and close your books in hours instead of days. Businesses that use Ramp add up to 5% to their bottom line the first year. If you're a decision maker, adding Ramp could be one of the best decisions you've ever made. And now get $250 when you join Ramp for free. Just go to ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy.
Cards issued by Sutton Bank and Celtic Bank, members FDIC. Terms and conditions apply.
But what, so I guess for you, going through all these experiences, has there been one that's, you know, there have been some that have been good, some that have been less good. Has there been one that has been particularly special for you?
There have been a couple. First of all, but the reality is, when you start out, you're so desperate for some success and some attention that it's very hard to enjoy the process because you feel the stakes so viscerally. Even with that said, I always enjoyed the process. I mean, there have been some that were harder to find that joy, but I go to every rehearsal. I go to every performance. I like doing it. I like being in the room with people who are making theater. I like seeing what my words, how they affect the actors. And so they're all good. They're all the worst experience I ever had in the theater, which wasn't here. I realized at the end, as hard and unpleasant as that experience was at times, it was better to have made something, and there was still a great deal of joy in the having made something. And that sounds so Pollyanna, and I don't think people who know me think of me as very Pollyanna-ish, but I really do enjoy it. And I feel most, I only write plays to get in. I don't write plays for the literary aspect of it. I write plays to get into the room with people that I'm going to have a good time with. Mm-hmm. Certainly, Pterodactyls doesn't stand out in my mind as a great experience. I was too young and too scared. I mean, it was an important experience, but it wasn't all that much fun until we opened. And then it changed because right. we did so well. Raised in Captivity was a really fun experience. And I would say The Lions was a really, really special experience for me. And not because it transferred, but because I had done two plays in a row that were not particularly well received. And you know this, I had really reached a sort of emotional ebb. And I didn't know why I was continuing to do it, if people weren't interested or didn't like me, and did I have anything left to say. And you invited me to see the Scottsboro Boys when it transferred on Broadway, and I cried. And I was so moved by the adventurousness of it and my, even if it was tangential, relationship with the theater that would go out on that limb. And it was about the same time. I don't know what the timeline is. Mm-hmm. I wrote The Agony, and The Agony, because I thought, if I'm done, I'd rather have a good time.
Right,
one more
right,
time.
Right.
And you were so sweet, and we did the lab of it. And it was a blast. It was the
it really
most
was.
Fun I ever had.
And you were in it.
I was in it.
Remind
and
people.
I was damn good, as Doug Abel
damn
would
good,
say.
Damn good, yeah. He likes to, that's jam.
But it was. I was never nervous
right.
to do it, to get
right.
up there and do it. It was. I filled it with people that I really wanted to have mm-hmm. fun with. And still, I had written The Lions, and I didn't know if it would get done. It was I had to sort of wait a while and fight a while. And it was really because of Mark and Linda and Michael Esper that it was.
Mark Brokaw, our brilliant director.
And Linda Lavin and Michael Esper, who were in the cast. I love the whole cast, but I knew Michael going in, and Linda being so warm and generous to me. You know, we never thought we'd get her. She was going to mm-hmm. do another play that was moving already committed mm-hmm. to move to Broadway. I remember the first reading, and Mark and I exchanged a look, and maybe you were in it too. It was like, this is special. It felt very special to me.
Including that we had an earthquake that day. If you recall.
Was it the first day we had the earthquake?
I do have to tell this story briefly.
But it felt very, very, it felt amazing. Special from the first minute. It felt
during
special.
About 10 pages in, we were rehearsing at a rehearsal studio. I think it was at New York Theater Workshop. I suddenly felt like I was turning green because I noticed that everything was shaking. And I thought that we were in this old building that it was about to collapse. And I stared over at Linda Lavin, who I just met, and she looked at, like, she and I share that. I don't think anyone else realized it, but it was like the earth was moving as this play launched.
Well, you were feeling that, and Mark and right. I were having magic.
Right. But anyway, there actually was a minor earthquake for the first and only time in New York City that moment, which was something.
I don't. It's important to me. I don't want to give, you know, shortchange Dick Latessa or Brenda or
Gregory
Waddell,
right?
Who is so lovely and wonderful. And I mean, he was in it before we came here,
right?
Because he had done a reading. I'd done a bunch of readings with very illustrious actresses, and the play didn't work.
Right.
And fine actors, but Michael and Gregory had done a reading and their chemistry was right, and so they were packaged.
Sometimes also it's just fun. I go back to Beautiful Child, which was a really interesting play.
And hard.
Hard, and it was about something really difficult, but in retrospect, you know, getting to work with actors like Penny Fuller and George Grizzard, and
Genius.
It was one of the last plays I think he did on stage, or maybe he passed away a few years after that, and he was a brilliant actor, and just for me, I'm sure for you too, just the fact that this amazing, venerable actor chose to work with us, you know, and take on this really difficult play. There was something magical about it.
He would have one drink every night at about 7, and to calm himself down. And I said, George, you've opened all the Albee plays on Broadway in giant houses, and you've won every award there is, and you still get nervous in the basement of a supermarket? And he goes, it doesn't matter. It's all the same.
Yeah,
going
yeah.
up there, it's always the same.
There's something special, again, at particularly this theater, I find, when you work with different generations in under one roof and on one show. It's really special.
Generation.
Yeah, it is really weird to be that.
It's unpleasant. I, of course, look very young.
You do.
Not so much.
Okay, well.
But I'm just saying.
There it is.
No, he looks fresh as springtime.
Oh, thank you.
After Pterodactyls, first, a lot of my agent wanted, I had an offer for Food Chain to go commercial, and I didn't want it to be the second play. I wanted it to be the third play. I felt very strongly about that. I wanted Ray's to be the second play. And he said, but you have a commercial offer. You have to take it. And I said, I don't have to do anything. And so he was mad at me. He got over it. But you took me to lunch at French Roast on the Upper West Side.
And I really don't completely remember this.
Well, I'm sure
I vaguely
it was you.
Do, but
it must have been you.
I think it was me.
And
I used to live up there.
What do you want to do next? Because I would like to be able to continue my relationship with you. And I said, well, I have another play. Now, at that point, a lot of theaters suddenly wanted to do a play by me, and different theaters offered to do Raised in Captivity. Circle Rep put a big fight up.
And look where they are now.
Well, gone.
Yeah.
But I wanted to be, it wasn't just that Pterodactyls was a good experience. I felt it was important to be loyal. And it has paid off for me in spades because almost, well, 26, 27 years later, I'm still here. And that play was Raised in Captivity. And I think a lot of people probably thought, well, not, they didn't think it, but you always want to know, you're always curious, was that one play that was successful? Is that it? Do they have a second play even in them? And Raised, critically and commercially, critically was a bigger success.
Right,
and commercially,
right.
We filled both. They were equal. They were absolutely equal.
And that was close to a perfect experience, at least for me.
It was just a beautiful,
great cast, a beautiful play. It just all came together magically.
One of the rare times where every actor saw and heard the play in their head exactly as
right,
as
and everybody
other.
Brought their A game to that. It was just perfect, and
we did that reading, the 25th anniversary reading for the theater, and it was like not a day had
magical,
passed.
Right? And it was, you know, it was bittersweet because at the time we actually couldn't extend the play because of some cast conflicts. We really tried, and so it was seen for 6 weeks or so by, you know, the New York intelligentsia, and that was it. In another time and place. Maybe
it's always
it
better,
had,
though, to get the best show you can and not worry about an extension.
Oh, absolutely. But I just still think of that as I don't remember any fighting or feuding. Not that there was on other shows, but it was just a very happy time for everybody, and no one felt pressured on that show. You know,
that was followed by the dark years.
Well, they weren't so dark.
They weren't so dark.
They were an interesting period, you know.
But there's also...
And if we follow the political thing, we did have to go through the Bush years,
we did.
Right? And that was challenging.
There's also, I mean, I was so spoiled, to be honest. I was so spoiled because it seemed like I could just keep writing plays and keep seeing them. The idea that I would spend a season doing The Altruist is odd to me almost now because it is a farce. It doesn't have, its darker underpinnings are so underpinned.
Right.
But, you know, I wouldn't do that now.
Right,
because
right.
now I feel like a production is a rare thing.
Right, right.
And it doesn't get easier. I was bemoaning with a friend of mine how, for a playwright, life never gets easier. It doesn't get easier. You're a beginner as long as you're doing it. And he said to me, he was seated across from, I'll say his name because he's my favorite living playwright, John Guare. And John Guare was all in a nervous fit because he was waiting to hear about some regional theater possibly doing a workshop of a new play of his. And I thought, it's John Guare. It really doesn't get any easier, does it?
And he, too, is one of my idols. And I think back to when I first came to New York, when I was in high school and Joe Papp was running the Public Theater. And one of the things I most admired about him was that he got behind certain playwrights and just produced them.
Oh, no, John Guare got behind me. John Guare was a big supporter.
No, absolutely. But I go back to Papp, who regularly produced some really wild and interesting John Guare plays. Sometimes they were well received, sometimes less so. But there was just a passion for producing the work, even though it was messy. And he was he is such a marvelous writer, and it was a thrill. I think the first time I came to one of your plays,
because John Guare, the thing about John Guare that I would hope I have 5% of. Whether it's a good play or a bad play, whether it's because every play is an experiment, is he loves the theater. Mm-hmm. And you can tell. Right. And he doesn't write a play that he doesn't need to write at that moment. And we'll end with this. One of the things that I like about this play, about This Day Forward, is I think the audience leaves having a sense that, you know, depending on how deeply you want to look, whether you're, but that I love the theater.
Absolutely.
It embraces so many different moments in the theater. We go from what really feels like a Neil Simon play. It doesn't feel like a farce. It feels like a Neil Simon play. And it sort of elevates to Kaufman and Hart, elevates to frantic bellboys running in and out. And then it gets even more demented, and it almost enters like Charles Ludlam territory. And then the mask falls off with a thud, and you're in realism.
Right.
And then we go into Act Two, and we're in modern, contemporary, non-linear theater with gay characters and a direct address and ghosts,
flashbacks and fantasies.
So I hope, honestly, that people leave with a sense of loving the theater as an art form as much as they leave with a sense of any story or message. I mean, no message. There's no message. Don't leave with a message. I sound like I think I'm great. And
no, well, I'll just say when I first read it, I fell in love with it, and you know that I'm picky, actually, and will not do a play unless I feel a passion for it, and that's true with Sarah as well. And I thought it was. What I loved about the play was that it felt both very mature and very young at the same time. You know, and it cavorts around in a lot of theatrical styles and places, but at its heart is a really, I think, a really powerful and sober and a real exploration of trying to figure out what's at the root of a family.
Well, that's exactly right. What the play, you know, we talk about, like, my plays are all about families. This, to me, because you would have thought, okay, the lines, he's done. How much more can he say? And then I did, you know, Too Much Sun, which really was a play for Linda. But this, to me, is like when you see, like, the Star Wars, and then they go, oh, we want to do another one, so we're going to tell the origin story. That's what this play is. This play is the origin story of all the other plays.
Right.
And then we move forward from it at the, you know, in the second act, but it really is the origin story of how Rita ended up where she is, and how Grace and Pterodactyls ended up where she is. It's the origin story of all of them.
And I think people can really relate to it. I have to say, on a personal note, I was reading a draft of it this summer when I was visiting my mom in her later days. And I don't want to give away anything about it in the play, but let's just say that my siblings and I were experiencing a parent imagining that we were a brother or a husband, and not who we were. And God, life imitating art. But it was really, you know, I think people can and do and are really relating to that experience. And of just at the end, the final question of where do we go from here, and can we make sense of this? Can we make sense of this life journey?
And you know, there, isn't, really there profound. Isn't an answer.
Right.
The journey is the journey is about asking the question, because I don't know the answer. If anybody knew the answer, we'd be done. What's the answer? I don't know the answer.
I don't either, except...
you do the best you can, minute by minute. That's about it. I've sounded self-important and wise.
Yeah,
both wise
and self-important.
We need
to end on something very silly, I think.
All right.
But I don't know what.
The play is young. The play is both young and very old. Like, internally, I'm very old, but I look very young.
You look fabulous.
It's a hair transplant. Dr. Allpeter has done wonders by moving the hair from the back.
I do like that when you go through personal experiences, obsessions.
They find their way.
I remember when Nikki was first, may I say this, like I got a hoot out of in The Altruist when Nikki was doing a certain kind of diet.
I'm still doing it.
Right, low carb. That became the centerpiece of, uh-huh, of a rather frenetic monologue for Vian Cox. And sure enough, there's a hair transplant joke,
exactly,
in our new play.
And it lands every night.
Boy, does it
probably
land.
Jinxed it.
Yeah, it'll probably be bombed.
Probably. Right, but yes, whatever. I one day I was working on another play and I was watching Now Voyager the night before. Whatever is in front of me, I'm like a toddler. And a line went into the play that a woman looked like Betty Davis's mother in Now Voyager. If Betty Davis's mother in Now Voyager were a $5 hooker who gave hand jobs behind the 5 and 10. It doesn't even make sense, but it was like whatever is in my world ends up in the play.
Right. Sometimes in your plays, a character will say something like, I'm just saying, and I know that that's something you say all the time, and it always cracks me up, you know.
Oddly enough,
well, you wrote them, so.
No, there you are.
But
some people are not at all like their plays. Christopher Durang is a darling fellow whose plays are so violently, emotionally, mm-hmm, violent, and he's so sweet. Mm-hmm. I'm very much like my plays.
Well, sweet and
sour
sometimes.
But I would like, if anybody hears this, who is a member of the Vineyard family, so to speak, the audience, I would like to take a moment to say, listen, it's almost 30 years that I've been here, and you've been supportive of me, and you've been supportive of me through thick and very thin. Very thin. Some bad times.
I'm talking about your waistline right now.
And how meaningful it is to me that you stand by me. Because it's probably my last play. I got nothing more.
Stop.
I'm out of juice. I'm out of juice. From now on, I'm done. I'm going to go shopping. I love QVC. I'm going to go shopping and spend my last few dollars, and then I'm done. I'm out.
On that.
That somber note.
we'll conclude this.
Well, that's it for Theater Uncorked at the Vineyard. Thank you so much to Nikki Silver and Douglas Abel for joining us on the podcast. Theater Uncorked at the Vineyard is produced and edited by me, Eric Parkach, Vineyard Theater's Director of Communications and New Media. With help from Melissa Pelkey, our marketing director, and Ali Scott Bennett, the Vineyard's associate producer. Our theme song is by the amazing Peter Lerman. Thanks to the Vineyard's artistic directors, Douglas Abel and Sarah Stern, and the entire Vineyard staff. If you enjoyed this episode, do us a favor and rate and review us on iTunes. It helps spread the word. And last but not least, thanks to you for listening to Theater Uncorked at the Vineyard.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org. Because only together we rise.